my name is Anne Marie Danimus. Of course, I am a senatorial candidate for the 4th District. I am Washington, I typically say born and raised, but I was adopted. I was born in Oregon, but since a day old, I have been a Washingtonian. I've lived a variety of different places, just various adventures in my life, but I have always made Washington my home. I've been in Spokane on and off in the last 34 years. I attended St. George's. I'm a graduate of Washington State University from the School of Communications, the Edwin R. Murrow School of Communications, of which I think you are familiar. Yes, go Cougs. I am a former Miss Spokane, and I was Spokane's junior miss as well in high school. I've always been very involved in a lot of levels of community service. I lived in Mexico for 9 years. I speak probably level 4 Spanish, and I am a MarCom professional with my own firm that focuses on business development. I have a nonprofit that I founded called Stubborn Girls Fund for Arts and Education. It's a 501c3, and I am a filmmaker. I've been involved in the performing arts most of my life, and I do films on social issues that educate the public. And eventually I would like to add senator to that resume.
So why do you want to add senator to it?
Well, I have always been extremely involved in government. I mean, if not on a volunteer level, certainly as an informed and proactive citizen. At one point, when I was younger, I had planned to be an attorney. In fact, I started out studying political science. And my goal as a young woman was to be a politician because I saw problems in the world and I felt like I could be part of the solution and not part of the problem. But I changed my career focus to broadcasting initially because I didn't feel that the day-to-day activities of being a lawyer was something that really suited me, even though I've always kind of been in love with the law. And I have pursued kind of my, lifetime commitment of solving problems and doing what I can in the community on through different means. And now I'm a little older and I returned back home to care for my mother, who is elderly. I lost my father just a couple of years ago. And it really seemed like the right time in my life right now. And I was kind of recruited to run as well by a handful of people when Representative Shea was still actively pursuing re-election.
So you would have challenged Matt Shea if he had run?
Well, yes. Initially, I had registered with the Public Disclosure Commission my candidacy for House of Representatives. And that was, the initial goal. And as we got closer to the actual time to register officially for candidacy, there were some rumors that he might switch to the Senate seat. And, because I had been recruited kind of for that race, I had a bit of tunnel vision, which funny enough is not typically like me. And I didn't realize that Senator Patton was not being challenged. And, his relationship with Mr. Shea has a lot of question marks on it for me. And, as well as, some statements and the way that he is moving politically, I felt like he needed a challenger. And the rumor was that Mr. Shea was going to switch races and hope to be unchallenged. And I wasn't going to let that happen. And I felt that not only would it be best for the fourth to have another candidate and certainly to make an attempt to head Mr. Shea's attempt to, continue to be a legislator off, but also there were benefits for me as well with regards to just my candidacy and the, the game that is politics, if you will.
Yeah. So you're running as an independent. Why choose an independent status?
Well, you know, it's really the most honest way for me to represent myself and my ideals. And certainly, you know, the political game, as I mentioned, it can be quite a deficit. You know, independents have a harder chance of winning. I don't have as much name recognition as the other two candidates in this race, and I'm not the incumbent. And so I'm, you know, going in as a triple threat of deficiencies, if you will, on what has been, you know, typically outlined as a successful run. But I also felt that the 4th District in particular would be more open to that. There is a lot of, you know, Republican fallout from Mr. Patton. They do not want to see him reelected. The Democrats and more progressive thoughts are, you know, slowly not taking over, if you will, but they're becoming a little more obvious, a little more active. I mean, the recent change in, you know, our mayor and city council has been demonstrative of that. And honestly, I just think that we need an antidote to the rhetoric and the kind of, you know, bipolar policy. People are getting tongued to the left and the right in this horrid game of tug of war. And really, in the middle is the people hanging like that white flag, and they're being drugged through the mud, and they're not getting the policy path that they need to better their lives. And so for a variety of reasons, I felt that was my best, and most honest pursuit of office.
So how do you describe your political philosophy?
Well, you know, I am a liberal libertarian. And what's interesting about that particular definition is that there's or classification, if you will, is there's a lot of things that can be assumed about that. Certainly, the standard libertarian values of, you know, individual rights is a strong determiner. And as an independent, certainly the Independent Party is very, and I don't affiliate with that party, quote, end quote, if you will, but, you know, individual rights and constitutional efficacy. Most importantly, constitutional efficacy. And that means everyone. That means everyone. And that is really where the liberal aspect plays into part. I don't believe in, you know, the every man is an island pursuit of freedom. I think that the safety net there is to ensure our freedom, to protect our freedom. Everyone, you know, even those who, especially those who cannot, for whatever reason, care for themselves. But on an economic level, liberal libertarians are quite different. And for me, I am very much about investment style policy. And Washington State is one of 10 states that has been rated by, you know, various political think tanks, if you will, as being employing investment style policy, but I don't think we're taking that far enough. And, you know, should my ideology get to the floor, that is the kind of policy that I'm going to push for, I'm going to write, and I'm going to support.
So let me ask you to get into that just a little bit more. What does investment style politics mean?
Well, you know,
policies mean?
You have certain, you know, social issues, if you will. I mean, outside of the basic mechanics of government of providing services for the whole of the community, you know, we have certain problems that we have to deal with in government. And a lot of times what we end up doing is treating the symptom and not treating the actual problem. You know, homelessness is a perfect example. The, you know, that the homelessness has a PR problem, the NIMBY attitude, and what are we going to do with the homeless as if they're just something that needs to be treated so they go away? And, you know, homelessness is a symptom of just a grab bag of problems. And so, yes, of course, we have to find a place to house them and to treat them and do intake. But we also have to focus on the problems that cause it. Focus on foster care is an example of investment style policy that I am promoting. And, you know, these aren't my ideas, but if you make sure that kids and families that are struggling get the help that they need, you are actually saving money in the long run. It never makes sense to patch half a roof. And that's what we end up doing. On the one hand, you have Democrats who want to patch. And on the other hand, you have Republicans who just want to rip the tablecloth out from underneath people who are barely standing. And like I said, you get this tug of war on policy, and the only people that lose when either side wins is the people. And we never progress. We just keep throwing money down a bottomless pit without actually designing two-prong programs that, one, obviously treat the symptoms of an issue, but also look at the underlying causes of the issue and invest our money that way. And that, of course, includes infrastructure.
So you're a strong supporter of the Black Lives Matters movement, correct?
Absolutely.
So the governor has put together a task force of folks to consider and recommend a group of police reforms to him for the legislature next year. If you were sitting on that task force, what are the reforms that you think you would support?
It's funny because I was talking to someone just recently about this. You know, I did live in Mexico for 9 years, and one of the issues with police reform is it's multi-jurisdictional. We have state police, we have county, we have municipal, of course, we have federal. And so you're dealing with, you know, kind of like a snake with multiple heads, if you will. And so, you know, there are some limitations to what the state can do when we're talking about municipalities or counties. So, one of the things that I would recommend, having lived in Mexico, I have seen the way they have managed their, you know, duty to protect and serve. We have sheriffs that sit on the side of the road. They make, you know, somewhere around $65,000, $70,000 a year, and they sit there waiting for people to drive by speeding. You know, they pick them up on taillights and traffic lights and things like that. It's kind of a waste of their time and a waste of their money. And, you know, the violence that police, some police are using, the abuse of force, again, can't just talk about that. We've got to go back and look at the problem. And part of the problem is that although not many police actually die while in the line of duty, I think it was 105 in 2016, 55 of those were felonious. We've got 1,000 people in 2018 that were killed by police. And certainly if you're committing a crime and you draw on an officer, you know, you might end up being killed. But conversely, with regards to the police, they are committing suicide at an extremely high rate. They get a phone call. They don't know if it's a rape or a murder or someone's dumping trash on my lawn, or they just won't turn the music down. And so I really think that in order to protect good cops and protect people of color, we need to completely dismantle the system and compartmentalize that. We're training people for 6 months to go out with a gun and handle things like mental health issues and abuse and all of these things, where if these people were in treatment or seeking, you know, help for that exact problem, they would be with trained professionals that have been, you know, to 4 years of school minimum to deal with that. And the police are just kind of randomly processing that. And not only is it not protecting and serving the public, it's not protecting and serving our cops. So I would look at splitting that up, you know, training our, in Europe, they train their police for sometimes 3-4 years. We've got 18-year-olds that can get out of high school 6 months later. They've got a gun and they're patrolling people on the street. I don't think that's the way that we do it. But the other side Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry, I'm talking forever here, but
that's fine.
And something that I'm focusing on personally is that we also have a problem with our justice system. Lady Justice is supposed to be blind, and that woman is peeking. And we, you know, Washington State was able to overturn its death penalty program to where we are not doing that anymore because of a study done through the University of Washington that demonstrated a massive level of bias. And we still have that bias. I met a woman the other day at the BLM, protest who had a 12-year sentence for a minor, like, youth-level drug charge where a white man who was actually dealing and traveling over state lines and had a tremendous amount of drugs at 18 months. And from the story, I believe, you can't quote me on this, unfortunately, but I think they were kind of arrested at the same time. There's a massive discrepancy. And you can backtrack. And you can say, you know what, I was treated unfairly and I need to appeal it or appeal my sentence. But we need a proactive way to look at sentencing, to look at prosecutorial overreach, and to look at probationary terms that are massively putting people of color at a disadvantage in society. And that's something that I want to look at. We're doing research. I'm meeting with some African-American leaders in my local community to really try and focus on that aspect of the problem, because it's not just when you're confronted with a cop. It's when you're confronted with the entire system of justice, and we are leaving our brethren of color behind.
So let me then just move to an area that's kind of the extreme there, that it hasn't been in the news a lot lately, but the death penalty has been raised by the governor and the attorney general, something they'd like to abolish in Washington. What do you feel about the death penalty?
Absolutely. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. There, we are one of like a handful of countries along with like Iran and China and, you know, all the places that we talk about as Americans. Oh, thank goodness I'm American. I don't live in a barbaric society. Well, really? I mean, really? And, you know, and of course I don't mean barbaric, you know, top to bottom, but with regards to, you know, how we're treated, I really think that we need to travel more, for one, but, you know, take a really good hard look at our country. You know, when I was on the fence with the death penalty as a young woman, and I became the president of Amnesty, became a member of Amnesty International, and then the president of our chapter at WSU for a year. And, you know, that's a great place to go to get some really good research on the death penalty if you're on the fence, because we have murdered far too many innocent people. Human beings are fallible, and it should never be in the hands of the government to essentially execute people. And not to mention the fact it would be a heck of a lot cheaper. It's a heck of a lot cheaper just to house them, let them run out their appeals on, you know, life without parole. And it costs the state millions and millions and millions of dollars to not only house death row inmates, but to also, exercise all of their appeals. So I'm absolutely opposed to it on many levels. You know, I think that we were unprepared. Before you make any kind of, you know, quarterback calls from your couch, you have to understand that we were absolutely unprepared. We were the first place to really have, you know, kind of an outbreak. I don't know if maybe New York beat us by a case, but, you know, we lost several of our elderly community right off the bat. And I think that, I think the way that he's handled it overall has been admirable, but I think going into it was where we failed. I think that on a federal level, that was just absolutely disastrous, and the way that it's continued to be, well, I can't even use the word handled really in the sense of my views on that, but Closing down all small businesses, boy, that was a rough cut. That was a rough cut. And the distribution chain for larger stores and whatnot, there was a lot of unfairness in the way that industry was handled. But I think that it was somewhat expedient and necessary, considering the unknown. And I don't think that we can really, really look at where and what mistakes were made and give the governor any level of grade until we can actually be in a point where hindsight is 2020. Because to use the word, how has he handled it? It's still ongoing. We are handling it, and cases have been spiking in several counties. Spokane is actually being looked at very, very closely, and because our numbers are going up. So this is not a past tense thing, even though other things come up, other things in the news, and it's summer and people want to enjoy the beautiful inland Northwest. But, you know, I'm sure there were mistakes made, but I don't think that we'll really be able to tell until it's over. And every time something like this happens, people say, well, we hardly had any cases at all. It's like, well, maybe that might have been because we stayed home, you know, and people aren't wearing masks. I just recently took a trip to California and back, and, you know, there's a lot more mask use. I drove, and every time I got out, there's a lot more mask use to our south, and they aren't seeing the increase in numbers like we are. So, you know, this has got to be a team community effort. I think he's, you know, really done his best with what he has had to deal with. But I think that, you know, what we need to do is think forward. And when we get all of the data in and our scientists, you know, have real numbers and, you know, really understand this virus, that's go time.
So let's stay with this for a minute. I just wanted to say, in terms of the coronavirus, it's really done a number on the state's economy. And if you're elected as a senator,
yes,
you would get to go to Olympia and figure out how to reduce a $7 million or $10 million, whatever deficit it's going to be. How would you approach that?
You know, I have several tax plans or adjustments kind of in the pipeline. And, you know, it's funny because coronavirus certainly caused a lot of economic hardship and a hit to the economy. But what it also did is it exposed weaknesses that already existed. You know, it would be foolish to blame the state of the economy on just the coronavirus, because had we been stronger going into it, we would not have been, you know, hit as hard. So to directly answer your question, I mean, you know, Washington State is 50th in relative income tax equality. For a progressive state, we have one of the most regressive tax systems in the nation, and there are some, you know, judicial decisions that are, you know, preventing us from doing certain things. We also have a B&O tax, which, you know, for most states that have a state income tax, it would be seen as a straight up money grab. It's an archaic system that most people got rid of like damn near a century ago. But we have to have revenue. And one of the first things I'd like to propose is that we make some adjustments to the B&O tax. You know, and they've been talking about raising certain industries. You know, Amazon always seems to be the monster under the bed when it comes to, you know, their taxes and the economy and what they contribute. You know, we have Microsoft in our state as well, Costco, Starbucks. And, you know, everyone said, well, let's go to them for the money. And so they want to tag different industries, and I don't agree with that approach. But what I do think we need in our B&O tax system is we need tax brackets. right now, if you are, you know, the carpentry trade, let's say, and you're just this guy, maybe you're retired and you make, you know, garden boxes in your garage and you're grossing $30,000 on a good year, and then you've got a cabinet maker who's, you know, doing $30 million a year, you're still paying the same percentage rate of taxes. And the margin on that cabinet maker is much, much deeper. He's making a lot more profit than, you know, just some guy in his garage trying to make ends meet. And I think that we need to take a serious look at that, because on the higher scale, we can increase their taxes by a much smaller margin across the board and give larger benefits to those that are, you know, the other like 90% or 80% of businesses to varying degrees. And that's going to do a lot, especially post coronavirus. I mean, I had the idea before, but even now, still the small business is hurting. If we transfer some of that tax burden and push it upstairs, this is also a balancing act against the moves the federal government has made, you know, trickle down economics just kills me. I mean, it's just been disproven time and time and time again. We're seeing the damages of it left, right, and center. And as a state, I think that we can do the opposite, and that, you know, knowing that these larger companies get so many benefits on a federal level until they figure out what the heck they're doing in D.C., you know, we are left here in Washington State to fill the gap. The other thing is, I think we need a one-year waiver on B&O tax for all new businesses. That's another idea I would like to propose.
Okay. Well, let's stay with one more tax. The $30 car tabs initiative that Washington voters approved fairly recently, again, is going to go to the state Supreme Court. Do you support that initiative, that idea?
Absolutely not. And to say Washington state voters is, you know, it's a bit of a hat trick, because only 45% of voters turned out for that vote, and it was a squeaker. It passed by 23%. So when we say Washington state voters, we have to remember that we're only talking about 23%, you know, give or take, percent of Washington voters. And I do think, I'm not an attorney, but I do think that they have a valid argument with regards to the constitutionality of that bill, the way that it was written. It wasn't balanced. I mean, you go into any contract negotiation, there has to be a meeting of the minds. And this is a contract with the constituents of this state. When they go in and they, you know, scribble in that little dot, they should have there should be a meeting of the minds. They should know what it is they are casting their vote for. And I don't think that that burden was met in this case. And I do hope they throw it out, because this is going to be a huge hit to our infrastructure. I mean, housing infrastructure, you know, homelessness affects that, our green movement infrastructure, our water rights issues, infrastructure. It's we can, and infrastructure is a jobs program. So yes, there were problems with tabs. They were being overrated in certain areas, but I hope it gets thrown out. I'd love to start from scratch. And if we can't, if it does pass, if it meets the burden and it becomes law, then we're going to have some serious scrambling to do to come up with money to cure that. I mean, another part that tabs paid for was public health services. And we all know we're lacking there. I think I read the other day from the Labor Council, $450 million deficit. That's $70 for over 2 years. That's a biannual. That's $35 a year for Washington state residents. Wow. That's a lot of money to make up.
Yeah. So those are my questions. Were there any issues that I didn't ask you about that are important that you want to talk about before we finish?
Well, yeah, we talked about a little bit about BLM and, you know, tolerance and equality and acceptance has always been very, very high on my list. you know, we also talked a little bit about, you know, problems that we have in society, things that need to be helped or maintained. And I think a lot of these programs, and I'm not saying that they're not necessary, because they are, it's we've made the bed that we're lying in by not writing policy that is comprehensive and that is inclusive. We are leaving people behind when we write policy. And because people are politicians, because, you know, they want their jobs, because they have party loyalties, they cater oftentimes to the majority. That's how you get elected. That's how you make the most people happy. But then when you tax them, you overburden them, because we need to catch up in certain areas to take care of people that we've left behind, because we've cast the popular vote, or we've written the popular policy in order to get it pushed through or whatever. We're making a great mistake. This doubles down being inclusive on investment style policy, because I'm not just talking about investing in infrastructure. I'm talking about investing in people, Washingtonians, and that means all of them. Our LGBTQ community, our people of color, our disabled, our elderly who have shockingly been disregarded in the coronavirus. You know, we have to build policy that includes everyone, that considers everyone, and that is forward thinking about what collateral damage. Because if we start doing that, we will find ourselves spending less money on fixing the damage that we've made in past years. And that is the way you balance a budget. That's the way you lower taxes, is that you solve problems by investing in solutions.